and offer reflections on the lives lost. That's from the Ninth Ward to the Airwaves, commemorating the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel D.I.s. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. This is the place where sports and politics collide at your home for jazz and justice. 89.3 FM WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. I'm Dave Zirin. I usually say I am joined, as always, by 11-year NBA vet and author Etan Thomas, as well as the guy who's always on the streets at every demonstration, Chuck Modiano. And of course, sometimes we have the coach, Kevin McNutt. Well, guess what? We are 0-3 today, other than yours truly. But we have a guest coming up in just a couple of minutes. I mean, given everything that's happening in Washington, D.C. right now, with the high-scale militarization by Donald Trump, the arguments to spread this kind of hyper-authoritarian militarization to other cities, the frustration of federal judges getting these absurd cases where people aren't read their rights, where there's illegal search and seizure, where there is racial profiling. I mean, it is an absolute calamity what's happening here. The New York Times just had a massive story about black families feeling less safe now because of the presence of South Carolina National Guard with live ammunition, 9mm guns, not to mention ICE trucks patrolling the neighborhoods, not to mention seeing National Guardsmen march around the Washington Monument. So while we do usually talk sports and politics, we're going to get a little deeper here this week. We need to talk about this city. We need to talk about this roots, the roots, and frankly, we need to talk about what I think was an utterly unholy betrayal by Mayor Muriel Bowser yesterday, who, while her constituents have been in the streets by the hundreds upon hundreds protesting what's happening, she stepped up to the microphone, our mayor, to praise Donald Trump, to praise the surge in law enforcement, to even praise Donald Trump for, and I quote, having an interest in our cities, long-term interest in our cities is how she put it. This is the Central Park Five, man. That's his interest in our cities, how to criminalize black and brown youth and to oppress the poor. That's what it's always been. And that's what it continues to be. And that's what it was when I was growing up in New York City with the Central Park Five, in case that is what Donald Trump was. That's how we knew him. And that's still who he is, because if he's changed at all since the 80s, it's only that he's gotten meaner. It's that he's gotten worse. And to see Muriel Powser actually reach out a hand to that and encourage it, I mean, that hurt a lot of people, and it makes things so much harder for those on the ground trying to organize. But we'll talk about all of that. Thrilled to have on the show. We don't have him for a lot of time. It's a big deal. He is a professor at Georgetown University. He has been in Washington, D.C. for so long. We're going to draw upon his personal history, not just his knowledge of history of this town. And he is the author of several books. The most recent one I recommend to everybody I know, and it is so perfect for this discussion, believe me. It's called Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience. Great title. How Black Washingtonians Used Music and Sports in the Fight for Equality. I can't recommend this book enough. I can't recommend this person's work enough. And I'm so thrilled to have him on the show, Dr. Maurice Jackson. Dr. Jackson, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine, and thank you for having me. It's the first day of classes at Georgetown, so I'm always more nervous going to my classes first day than I am if I was speaking to 1,000 people in the audience. So I'm glad to start the day with you. Thank you.
Let me just tell you before we start,
you know, this is the day in 1955 that Emmett Till was murdered. And so it's appropriate that we talk about all these things. And it's also the date, as you would know, the day that Elgin Baylor started his high school career in Washington. So,
wow, a double. So the arguably the best player in the history of the DMV, a special day for him. And inarguably one of the key pivots in the entire Black freedom struggle, the murder of Emmett Till. There's a beautiful and heartbreaking commemoration of his funeral service at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. But Lord knows how long it will be there, given the looting of that museum that's been promised by this administration. So, Dr. Jackson, I wanted to start with this basic question, just so our audience can learn a little bit more about you before we start talking about what's happening today. What is your history, political and otherwise, in this town of Washington, D.C.?
Thank you. Well, I came to Washington a long time ago. Actually, I came as an intern working for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and then I also intern in the office of Congressman Augusta Savage Hawkins. And then I just got active. I became active in the youth movement. I had joined the Communist Party as a very young man, so I was a leader, and I was probably a top leader for many, many years. And then I, over differences around, you know, perestroika at Glasnost, over differences about the shooting of young people at Tiananmen Square, I left that organization, politics per se, and then I had to find something. So I, you know, went and got my doctorate for years, and I've been fortunate enough to be teaching here. I'm trained in actually 17th and 18th century Atlantic history, but I'm able to teach a lot of courses in that. So, and out of this comes, of course, this book that you mentioned. And then another one that comes out next year on the history of African Americans in Washington, D.C.
And that's based on, I think, something that you've wrote previously called Halfway to Freedom. Is that correct?
Halfway to Freedom is the book that comes out next year.
Right.
By University Press. And I finished it, and it will, you know, come out. It's a very long, comprehensive book. It takes a different view. It doesn't look so much at institutions, but it looks at people.
Wow. I mean, you are a true historian of this city. So as a historian, let me ask you, what do you think about what we were seeing in our town right now? And does anything historically draw any kind of a parallel that's helpful for facing this current moment?
Well, I can only speak as a historian, as an African American, and you know, nothing really ever surprises you. You do as best you can to make the world better. You raise your children. I raised my children under the age of Obama, and I just thought the better world was coming. And then I look now. But in D.C., that's why I call this book "Halfway to Freedom." African Americans have always just had that halfway to freedom. African American men got the vote in 1870. It was taken away. The people of D.C. had some form of home rule in the 1870s. It was taken away and not given back until 1973. But they have been, you know, we speak about these guards. You know, during the Civil War, they had rebel soldiers were captured and put in jail on Capitol Hill, and runaway slaves were captured. And the rebel soldiers were treated better than the runaway slaves were. In 1919, there was a riot. White soldiers attacked black people who had just come back from the many who had just come back from the war, and attacked them viciously. And Woodrow Wilson was out on his yacht called the Sequoia. He was on the Potomac, just breezing it. And then when African American soldiers came home, they went to Baltimore. They couldn't get any weapons here. They went to Baltimore, and got weapons and came home and started defending their families. Only then that Wilson called out the National Guard. But this is not just the first time. Many would know that in 1968, the National Guard was called out after people were protesting the death of Martin Luther King. So, and then, you know, some years ago, some will remember that when a John Muhammad, you know, the man who went around in a white van shooting people, they called out the National Guard. And every now and then, if crime rates go up, they say they go up. I live not far from the Rock Creek Park, and the Park Service, they deputize the Park Service. So this is just nothing new. It's just we haven't seen on this scale. And for a black man who grew up in the South, it's nothing I want to see less than people coming from Mississippi, Alabama, from the National Guard, people who aren't trained for anything outside of a dislike for people of color.
Now, is this part of it, though, unprecedented, Dr. Jackson, the idea of mobilizing very intentionally these neo-Jim Crow National Guards, like from these states that certainly, even if the National Guardsmen themselves are multiracial in some way, like the idea of bringing up the people from these states that have so much symbolic weight in Washington, D.C. I'm going back to the Civil War, for goodness sakes. I mean, I was saying the other day that Jefferson Davis might be looking up smiling right now. Is there anything that compares to that in the history of the deputization, the federalization of law enforcement, and all the rest of it, drawing upon the former foes in the Civil War to occupy the city?
No, not quite like this, but understand that around Washington, they are, I think, 6 or 7 military bases, Fort Beauvoir, Fort Lee, Andrews Air Force Base. They are all these protective services that are in D.C. So all of those have been out in the street. The Secret Service, the executive police, the embassy police, the park police. So there are all these, like 14 different brands of police that you can see out patrolling almost any time when they call. So, but this of this magnitude, but you know, Walter Washington was the mayor during the 1968 riot, and it should be studied. He was a man of somewhat conservative bearings as African American people, but a great dignity. And he demanded when police went out in 1968, did they not have live bullets? Now, some violated him and did have live bullets. And when the National Guard came in, he demanded at first that they not have live bullets. And wow. It's a bit different. Now, we see that Hedgepeth, I get his name.
Pete Hegseth, that's right.
At first, they did not have live bullets. Now, they're authorizing them to use live bullets. People who aren't trained in any aspect of this, you know, National Guard is you know, the National Guard should be sent out to help with some of these disasters. But I've seen now that they have that they've been using them to spread mulch around the street. My wife and I were driving the other day. We saw these big things of mulch. We didn't know what they were there for. We had no idea they're going to use the National Guard. We went out to dinner the other night with some older friends, and this was a Saturday, and we just saw them at 14th and R Street. It's all up and down the street. And, you know, the president has said, oh, it's opening up and people are going out for dinner more than ever. Well, it's just not true. The streets, you see some young people who are more adventurous, but we were there. We did not see that many people out. And and so it sort of harks you back to, you know, what the National Guard general said in New Orleans, that when things like this happen, people don't come out. People stay in. So this is, but it's been encouraging. I've gone to a couple of rallies and been very encouraging to see people mobilizing in the street and wanting to stay in.
Definitely. You know, one of the points of mobilization in the city right now, and there are many, from demonstrations to cop watches to all sorts of things. But one of the instruments of resistance has been go-go music. There have been several go-go demonstrations where the volume is loud, the young people come out, and it's this incredible statement of, hey, this kind of dull gray shadow, which you just described, that they are trying to put over the city, is actually something that can be challenged with this music. And it reminded me very much of your book when you talk about the rhythms of resistance. Why does go-go hold that place in the community? And as a follow-up to that, why do you think go-go has never caught on in any other city or region in the United States?
Well, you know, you'd have to, you know, I'm a jazz man, so you'd have to have some of the go-go historians.
Sorry. Okay, I know, but you're a jazz man.
No, but though I did know Chuck Brown. But just the thing about go-go, you remember a couple of years ago, up at George Avenue, this gentleman had a go-go shop, and as people moved into the neighborhoods, they wanted him to stop his music. So you see go-go in one thing, you know. The one thing, and this has to be observed, that when troops came in 1968, the city was almost 70% black.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as the troops come in, they are patrolling a majority white. Well, not a majority, but there are more whites. I think whites are now 45% as opposed to maybe 42% of African Americans. So, mm-hmm. so it's a different ball game, and I suspect the troops are going to act a little differently. They're not going to, I wouldn't imagine, I don't know, but, when you see the people there resting, going there, my wife and I were driving, and we see, we saw near where we live, we saw the secrets, the park service stop everywhere. They saw people working on their houses or getting work done, stopping and going into those places, grabbing undocumented workers. So I think, you know, while at one point we do this, we must find ways to protect people who've come to this country, come to this city, seeking a better life, sometimes running from dictatorships, and now be treated like this. So this would be one of the first calls. Now, go-go, you know, I'm glad to hear this. I haven't seen it, and I hope it takes off with some of the, young white youth there. So I hope the go-go music. I hope they go to all wards. I hope they come to ward four, where I live at, and other places like that. Go-go has been a music of every city has its particular music. Mm-hmm. Washington has its go-go music because of the constant pulsating of the drums, the pots, the pans. People started go-go, really. There are many reasons, but, you know, in the 90s, the first thing that Mr. Reagan did, one thing he did was cut the budget, and he cut two things. He cut music programs out of the schools, and he cut out PE. And so when you cut these things out, PE, this is a way to keep kids fit and things like that. And we saw the rate of type 2 diabetes go up. But he also took out cut out some of the music programs. And so this took out, when I was a kid, everybody was in the band, whether you played or not. You played 5 minutes like me. And they took this, and young people started finding other ways of playing their music. You know, like the House of Prayer. If anybody old enough, you go to House of Prayer, the tambourines of glory, and they beat the tambourines, and then they have the drywall buckets, and young people took these and took instruments and made their own instruments and then used their voice, which is a wonderful adaptation of scat. You know, I could just see Ella Fitzgerald singing some go-go tunes if she were around with us. They were Andy Bay with their great scat voices. So go-go represents that, this young. I just hope that that many of the young white people in the city understand the importance of this music as a social phenomenon. Chuck Brown come from the South, North Carolina, like 90% of the black people in D.C. come from. Spent time in Lorden, found his voice with it, the guitar and voice, and started playing music. And then, of course, he, you know, I first listened to him when he and Eva Cassidy started singing Duke Ellington. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And I said, I got to listen to this brother because he's singing some in here.
That's tremendous. And Chuck Brown, of course, you know, a legend in this town. You know, one of the issues. Oh, you know, actually, I want to get back to this. You spoke about the changing demographics in D.C., which I personally think is sometimes it gets a little bit exaggerated. Like when people say, oh, it's a white city now or whatnot. Like I think, yeah, it's very different. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I would love to know what you think. I feel like the soul of the city still beats. I'll just ask you that right now. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, it beats some places. It beats in my house. But look, Bohemian Cavern, the great jazz club, one of the great jazz clubs in our country, is gone. When that building closed, the city could have done something to help Omaro Brown keep that place open. But it didn't. Mm-hmm. It went down and spent $50 million at Franklin Square. At what used to be the old Board of Education, and gave it to a philanthropist to start the Word Museum or something like that. But it could have, Twins Nightclub closed. So the Ventures on U Street closed. After the riots, there were three black businesses in Washington, D.C. left. Mrs. Ellie's and Ben Ellie's, Ben's Chili Bowl, Rick's Flower Shop, and Industrial Bank. Walk down U Street now, you don't see many more businesses than that. Now, we're fortunate you do so little Ethiopia because the Ethiopian people have been able to put their money together and open things. But African-Americans in general, now during the time of Marion Barry, there were a lot of small business loans and things. He had a man named Cortland Cox who come out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who became his a business liaison, and they gave all kind of grants to small business and things like that, but you don't see it really now. So yes, there are voices out there, but I'm afraid that the population is going down. And then you see something quite different. You go to the schools. I walk a lot, and I pass by the schools, and you see the schools. If you pass by certain neighbors in Northwest, you see the schools. You see the bright young kids, the black, the white, the Hispanic are playing together. You go to the high schools, it's just the opposite, because the high schools become a bastion of segregation because people like Jackson Reed and others now don't want kids from the other neighborhoods to come because, of certain things. So Jackson Reed has a chance of becoming much more segregated. So they in the public schools, I think maybe Jackson Reed, a little bit, maybe Duke Ellington, maybe a bit Banneker. And maybe the schools that are also, most schools, especially the high school level, are probably 80% either white or black. So you do see all those things that are happening, the big effects on the, Jason Moran was at the wonderful Jason Moran, who was at the Kennedy Center, just bringing jazz to people. Mm-hmm. You didn't have the bread to pay. You could go to an earlier show on the stage. And this brother was doing great things. And he came to Georgetown for 2 years as a distinguished artist in residence. He had to resign. He didn't have to resign. He resigned because on Juneteenth, because he just could not deal with this. One thing about the Smithsonian you mentioned, and under the leadership of Dr. Lonnie Bunch, they have been attacked. But as far as I know, no items have been removed. Mm-hmm. There was rumors that, for example, that Nat Turner's Bible was taken out and that Harriet Tubman Shaw. Well, it's not quite true. What happened is these items do rotate because of the light and things like that, and they're protected. There have been rumors that Emmett Till's casket. I think if they tried to take Emmett Till, I think that would be one thing that the people of D.C. would really rise up to. This is when you go to that museum, out of all the places, this is where people stop. This is where it stirs the people's imagination.
That buses and buses of black families and schools come to that museum.
Dave, I was over there 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. I walked in and there were all these young white kids. Hundreds, and they many of them had on red MAGA hats. Now I looked and I said, "What is this?" And then there was this young white teacher, this young woman, and she put them in order. She said, "Stop this noise! There will be none of this. You will pay attention." And they jumped to order, man, and they went through this museum. Not a single disruption. Not a single act of disruption. Now they had these caps on. Maybe their parents gave. I don't know why they had them on. But this young white teacher from Miss wherever she was, and I've seen other teachers like that. You go in this museum, you're going to act right. You see? And so, and then, you know, I know they were a discussion about the Miss Sherrod's painting of the trans woman Statue of Liberty. And from what I understood, from what I read, and I think I'm correct, that the Smithsonian did not demand that she take it down, or she took it down for that reason. What I think, what I read, the Smithsonian said that they were going to put a video or something to explain it. Well, that's somewhat, understandable. But no items have been removed. And as I understand, I've had fellowships at Smithsonian. I pay all my students go there, and especially the African American Museum. It is our treasure. And I listened to a tape. And maybe your readers should listen to this in New York Times. I think it's 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And New York Times put it on his website. And it was Mr. Trump who had gone to the Smithsonian. And he praised it about the great role he was doing in understanding the history of slavery. And he talked.
He said stuff he'd never. Yeah, they described him even as shaken up after he saw the chains, the actual chains that were used.
You got it. And this was in the, now it's not from Jackson. This is the New York Times, the paper.
Yes. It's unbelievable to me how absent of principles. Sometimes I get surprised anew how the absence of principles are part of our politics. It's just, I know. I don't mean to sound naive. So I guess I would say, I continue to be shocked, but not surprised. Here's a question for you that I really wanted to ask as someone who's been in this town. I want to talk to you about Mayor Bowser's reaction to all of this, as said yesterday. And before I read what she said, and before we even say her name, I would like you to say to me, please, just what you think Mayor Marion Barry, at his best, because we all know he had his ups and downs, but at his best, how would he have responded to what is happening in D.C. right now?
Yeah, I read Ms. Bowser's comments, and I don't quite know why she made them. The only thing that the one thing she should be saying, in my opinion, I think she said it, is that the D.C.'s budget has been held up, money, tax money, at $1.some billion. And the city had asked for 500 additional police. Now, this is during a time when it's hard for anybody to be, a black man to be asking for police. But I do understand why they are called for them. This is the level of cooperation to ask for the money to be released. But this notion of somehow overpraising this man is beyond me. I think some city council people, Representative Allen, Christine Henderson has been on the ball. I mean, and then my congressman, Ms. Jaleesa Brown, spoke out today where she really spoke out against what Ms. Bowser has done. Now, I imagine Ms. Bowser is saying that, well, I'm the mayor and I have to have this balance. And I don't know exactly what she's thinking. She has there's no chance of anybody right now defeating her. She's I think going into a 12th year. So the city council people are adequately are speaking up. What Marion Barry have done? Marion Barry came to D.C. in I think 65 or so. He came to work in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee office, and he helped form something called Free D.C. And what Free D.C. Did was went all around the city, putting signs in all the businesses, demanding that they hire black people, demanding they gave small business loans. You know, In the 60s and 70s, African Americans could not get small business loans, period. And could not get, you know, the redlining was all over the place. You could not buy a house. Houses had covenants in it. If you wanted to move to a neighborhood that was deemed white, you couldn't buy it. No blacks, no Syrians, no Semites. They would even say no Semites, which meant no Syrians, no Arabs, no Jewish people. Nope. It had these things written into the clauses. And Marion Barry joined with a man named Julius Hobson and Douglas Moore, who came out of CORE. And they formed this this Free D.C. movement, and it had a big effect. And the first challenge with them was against a man named O'Roy Chalk, who owned the Washington Transit Society, a New Yorker who came to Washington, who had his office in the bus barn at Georgetown. And this campaign had signs all over. And Chalk wanted to raise the fare from, I think, 25 to 30 cents, which was a lot, you know, a good percentage. And they boycotted, and they had a 2-day boycott of this. And I just read the figures last night. 150,000 people did not ride that bus the next day. And Chalk said that, well, it had nothing to do with this, but he changed his plan. And the city demanded, and what they demanded, they were, I think, maybe one or two police, black police, above the rank of lieutenant. And they demanded that this be. You know, I was looking at the other day at some photos from 1941 in Washington, D.C., and this was a campaign against police violence. And they had the police chief, I think his name was Police Chief Davis, who came out with the National Negro Labor Congress and himself led a demonstration against police brutality. Now, we see the present police chief for all in purposes, probably a wonderful woman, I don't know, but missing in action. Now, I know she does come from the Federal Protection Police Force. I think that's where she was from. So I don't know why she's speaking. But yes, so well, Marion Barry, do you know that Julius Hobson, the great Julius Hobson, you know, yes. I see Trump talking about rats and things like that. Julius Hobson once, as a ploy, went and collected rats. Not, I teach in Georgetown. Georgetown has the biggest rats. The Georgetown rats are bigger than they are in New York City. I've seen some big rats in New York, but not as big as I come across campus sometimes at 4 o'clock. I come to work very early in the morning, 4 or 5. And Julius Hobson went and got a cage full of rats and let him off in front of the White House. I mean, he would do and things like this. So now it's the time of, you know, of mass protest. The mayor should be out there letting the people know that she is their leader. Now, is she going to get arrested for something? I don't know. I would say this. The movement today in Washington needs to learn a lot from prior movements. They especially need to learn from the Free South Africa movement. The Free South Africa movement was led by African-American women, Sylvia Hill, Cecily Count, Neana Kekene, and many others, who went out and mobilized the city all over demonstrations against apartheid in South Africa. And every week, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of little older ladies and older men and young people and busloads, they came from all over, and they got arrested right there. I mean, what an example. And it did help to end apartheid. I think it's just time for some mass actions to go out. You know, ringing the pots and ringing the bells, that's good. But we got to take this, in my opinion, some of these things had to be taken downtown. I'm not calling for violence. I'm not calling for anybody to do anything except what they have the constitutional right to do, and that is stop the unconstitutional usurpation of authority in Washington, D.C.
I'm going to ask my producer right now, Magic Mike, if we could go on until 10:40 with to take a break, because that's when Dr. Jackson has to leave. So hopefully Mike will chime in on that, because I have so much to ask you. All right, so let's actually now, this is what I really wanted to do with you. I wanted to actually read the comments by Mayor Bowser, and I want to do it for a very simple reason, Dr. Jackson, because I am getting a lot of feedback from people, as I have been critical of Mayor Bowser, who have said, what do you expect her to do? She's in this corner. She has to be diplomatic. And I just want to read this. Like, the lead of the news story was D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser on Wednesday credited President Donald Trump's directed surge of federal law enforcement. And she says, We greatly appreciate the surge of officers that enhance what MPD has been able to do in this city. And she praised Trump's quote unquote interest in cities. Now, a statement like this, when people are organizing, is like a punch in the stomach. And it, but also, I would argue it hurts the mayors and governors who are standing up to Donald Trump right now and telling him he can't send in the feds or the National Guard.
Yeah.
Now, are you sympathetic at all? And I'll be honest that I'm not, but I respect you so much. Dr. Jackson, are you sympathetic at all to the argument that Bowser is doing what she has to do, and there actually is an argument for her to take this approach?
No, I'm afraid I have no sympathy with this. I'm sympathetic to the men and women who are being hauled off the street because they come in for a better life. I'm sympathetic to the young kids who have to cross barriers to go to school. I'm sympathetic to all the federal workers, the D.C. workers, by these arbitrary plans. No. She did not have to say that. Some things you have to say. Maybe you didn't have to say that. Priska, you know, I don't remember. You remember the Democratic convention? He was quite, I think his name is Priska. He's the governor. And he came out and he says, I'm a billionaire. And he's bragging. In essence, he was saying, I got as much money as Trump. I'll go up against him. So he would say, and then the mayor of Chicago and others, the mayor of, and this man is going out after all black cities. So basically what this says, it's just, okay, go out after all these black cities and black mayors. I'd like to think that she said that in a moment of dismay, or one of her aides wrote it. I would like for her to come out and explain that. I don't know why in the world you have to think a man. Crime is down. You know, we've seen that. And let me tell you something. You know, it was a great revolutionary once said, somebody asked you, what you do with all the prisoners? He said, we let them go, all except the criminals. They are criminal elements. We all know this. We all want crime prevention. We all know that, you know, we may not like what they do sometimes. What we need is a community responsive and a police that respects people. And the mayor asked for those 500 people. I could see her asking for this, but to praise the actions of what is done. And then he says he's going to stay 30 more days. And then I've seen this. As I saw in the New York Times somewhere today, that they're pulling all grants from all kids of immigrants. They've already cut back the free breakfast programs, which means thousands and thousands of black and white kids not going to be fed. These are things you should be speaking out about because they affect Washington, D.C. But no praise for nothing this man has done. He's going after everything that is dear to us. He's going after every comment about black and Latino people. He's been a bigot. The comments about gay and transgender people, he's been a bigot. About the poor, about people who have some form of disability, he's made fun of women. No leeway. You don't have to do it, because in this case, the people of D.C. are behind you. What you do is demand that you get your $1 billion back, which is D.C. Taxpayer money. I hope that it was a misstatement. I just don't know. And I hope that the city council people, I haven't seen much there.
No.
You know, and they're the elected representative of the people. I've seen it from my city council, Jalise, in Ward 4. I've seen it from Ms. Henderson. You know, Mark, you're a sportsman just like I am. You know much more than I do. And, you know, I looked at all the lobbying these people did around the commanders. Man, they just, you know, they curtsied. And all the ripper around that, $1 billion to the commanders. But I want some kind of unity around this. You know, people don't know. And you know, in this book, I talk about the whole history of football in Washington. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you do.
And the theme, you know, was hail to the Redskins, hail victory, hail to the Redskins, hail to old Dixie. And Dixie was saying until the late 1960s. And this Trump is coming here singing Dixie right in our city right now.
Yep. And I think you would agree with me that there's a racism to attacking statehood, if for no other reason that the very statehood movement of 1973, and home rule was a product of the Black freedom struggle.
Very much so. And, you know, in the 70s, you know, so many people were in town. So many people came because many had worked for Marion Barry, but they also had a lot of whites who came, who had been visionaries, who had wanted to work with the Peace Corps and all this. And so you had these people, some very wealthy, but they still joined the lines and supported a home rule. You know, I talk about, you know, in this book coming out, the role of Fauntroy had been the first elected delegate, and now he went out and mobilized busloads of people to go down to Carolina to mobilize against John McMillan, who was the head of the House District Committee, and the big impact upon this. I haven't seen much from Mrs. Norton. I've hardly seen hardly anything, and of course, Mrs. Norton isn't as young as she used to be, and perhaps. Perhaps she will. She's a brilliant woman, one of the most brilliant people I've ever seen, a constitutional lawyer. But sometimes it's just time to move along. So I hope that I hear more from what is happening in that way. And then the elected political leaders, the preachers, the other preachers, they got to get out there and have to have a meeting. If I'm the city leaders, I'm having an emergency meeting. I'm calling for an emergency meeting with the mayor today. To explain this, you know, it's you know, you can't be dictatorial about this any more than we can let Mr. Trump do it. You have to listen to the people. You have to listen to in this city, and the people are coming out speaking. You don't have to do this. You don't have to say that. You don't have to whistle Dixie.
You don't have to whistle Dixie. I can't think of a better way to end this interview. And I also, even though I could talk to you for 80,000 hours, you just said yourself, you've got your first day of classes, you got the butterflies, and I want to let you go so you can get your head on like you knew do. Because let me tell you something, Dr. Jackson, I don't mean to kiss the butt here, kiss the tush, but I've met some of your students, and your class is always their favorite. So that's one thing I always take to heart when I talk to you.
Well, good. I hope my wife is listening to the show so she can, you know. It's always great talking to you, and I look forward to one day meeting Mr. Thomas. I've never met him, but I look forward to it.
Oh, heck yeah. The book is called Rhythms of Resistance and Resilience, How Black Washingtonians Use Music and Sports to Fight for Equality. It couldn't be more right on time for this moment. Thank you so much, Dr. Jackson.
Thank you all. Good day.
Wow. That was Dr. Maurice Jackson. That was really powerful. I can't wait to spread that show around these interwebs. We got to take a station break right now. We're 12 minutes late for doing it, but to me, it was worth every second. We'll be right back on The Collision on WPFW, because that is where we are trying to change this world, one broadcast at a time.
We are all Kilmer. We are all Kilmer. We are all Kilmer. We are all Kilmer.
Independientemente lo que pase hoy.
Regardless of what happens here today.
Con eyes, prométenme esto.
In my eyes checking, promise me this.
Que seguirán luchando, orando, creyendo en la dignidad y la libertad, no solo para mí, para todos.
Promise me that you will continue to pray, continue to fight, resist, and love, not just for me, but for everybody. Continue to demand freedom.
I'm here in Baltimore City, outside of the Baltimore ICE facility, where Kilmer Abrejo Garcia just went in for a mandatory ICE check-in at 8 a.m. this morning, and they immediately took him to custody and have taken him to places that we do not know.
Mr. Abrejo Garcia was taken into custody by ICE this morning. There was no need for them to take him into ICE detention. He was already on electronic monitoring from the U.S. Marshal Service and basically on house arrest. The only reason that they've chosen to take him into detention is to punish him. To punish him for exercising his constitutional rights. His constitutional right to fight back against being illegally deported to El Salvador. His constitutional right to speak up through his court filings on the torture and treatment that he received in El Salvador at the direct request of our government.
Kilmer Abrejo Garcia was incorrectly arrested and kidnapped and sent to a facility in El Salvador, a notorious torture prison. Even the Trump administration said, we made a mistake. It was an administrative error. Ah, but here's the problem. The lawyer who said that was immediately fired. And since then, and with the outcry, there has been a full court press to make sure that Kilmar Ablejo Garcia pays. So Kilmar is actually key to their agenda. They want to show that they can send him to Uganda absent of any reason whatsoever. They want to sell the idea that due process is no longer a part of the United States. They want to sell the idea that they can be as cruel to possible to people. And if people accept that cruelty, if they accept the lie that someone like Kilmar Abrejo Garcia is a danger to the community, well, then people then become complicit in the lie. But guess what the response is? Kilmar Abrejo, his family is out here today. His union is out here today. Politicians are out here today. Casa de Maryland is out here today. And hundreds of organizers and well-wishers and people who just are just fed up with what's happening right now, they are out here today too. Because as Camille Kilmar says, it's not just about me. It's about entire communities that are being terrorized. Well, guess what? The people out here, they're saying we're going to make the terror stop right now because the wrong people in this country are afraid right now and the right people are way too confident. Yo, let me do a little back announce, everybody. This is Dave Zirin here on The Collision, your home for jazz and justice, of course, WPFW. The Collision is where sports and politics collide. Usually I'm joined by 11-year NBA veteran and author Etan Thomas, as well as protest maven and journalist Chuck Modiano. We get the coach, Kevin McNutt. It is solely I today, but if you are listening to the first part of this show and if you missed it, by all means, go back and hear Dr. Maurice Jackson speak about the history of DC and what we're dealing with right now. But what we just heard was me at the courthouse in Baltimore on Monday at the crack of dawn, got there at 6 a.m. to witness and stand with Kilmar Abrejo Garcia of Temple Hills, Maryland. And as I just told the story, you all heard it. I just want to say that, like, we got to be vigilant about this because, as I said in that, this is about the normalization of the end of due process. And Kilmar is critical to the Trump administration. He's become the symbol of that. And he's become the symbol for our side, too. So we got to fight for him. Okay, we only got a few more minutes, left on the show. And I really want to talk about the retirement of John Wall, if I could. This is something that is extremely, extremely important to me and something that I believe hasn't gotten nearly enough publicity as it needs to. I mean, I don't think people understand that basketball, and we could have talked about this with Dr. Jackson all day. Did you notice that at the start of the interview, he made a big point to mention two things? The anniversary of the killing of Emmett Till, which we should all recognize, and the high school debut of Elgin Baylor, arguably the greatest player to ever come from this area. And I don't think people outside this area realize what a basketball hub it is in the DMV. I mean, local product Kevin Durant even produced a documentary called Basketball County in the Water, about all the pros that come from here. So we've got this incredible basketball culture here. You see it on all the courts every weekend. You see it in AAU. You see it at every level. And yet, in the pros, we have a team in the Washington Wizards that hasn't won 50 games since before E.T. phoned home and hasn't won a championship since Jimmy Carter was sitting at 1600. God, can you imagine Jimmy Carter with that gold-plated Oval Office? It's shocking to me sometimes how vulgar and repugnant we've become. So in this area, there is basketball love that is disconnected from our NBA team. I see much more basketball love at Mystics games than I do at Wizards games. And the only time in my years in D.C., that I have seen, I've been here a long time, that I have seen a iron connection between the city and the team, between the schoolyards and the team, was at the height of the John Wall Washington Wizards, cut horribly short by injury. But I don't want to forget how much John Wall meant to the schoolyards of this city. I don't want to forget what it was like to see him on that court with the Quicksilver speed, the Slam Dunk Award winning hops, and the 360 degree open floor flair. Now, I want people to realize that John Wall really meant something from a hoops perspective, and because he meant so much to the community, because he was so real, because he was so authentic to the community, and also because he poured money into our community. Because of all of these things, it made it that much more important when John Wall joined Bradley Beal and several members of the Washington Mystics, who really did the lead in terms of the organizing. Shout out Natasha Cloud, played a huge role in that. But to see John Wall at the front of the march, holding a megaphone, leading the chants, 2020, police murder of George Floyd, John Wall at the height of his cultural powers, John Wall with a mural of him on the side of Ben's Chili Bowl, which, as Dr. Jackson told us, was one of only three businesses left standing on that whole Black Broadway because they were Black-owned businesses. Black-owned businesses that were left standing. And one of them was, of course, the famous Ben's Chili Bowl. John Wall being on the side of Ben's Chili Bowl could not imagine a bigger DC honor. I want people to remember all of this, because we miss him, not just for the hoops, but because he represented an independent base of power in the city. And Lord knows we need that right now with this occupation, because Muriel Bowser, Mayor Bowser, is not an independent source of people power. She is officially a handmaiden to the federal occupation of Washington, D.C. She is what we would call a collaborator, or a Vichy mayor, to use the old German term of people who would collaborate with the German Nazi party. So I say all this to say that we miss John Wall terribly right now. But at the same time, I do feel like John Wall leaves a legacy here to remind us what it feels like on a grassroots level in the city, what it feels like, to use the words of Dr. Maurice Jackson, for sports to be part of the rhythm of resistance in this town. We have not seen athletes step up since the start of this occupation. There is no Jedi Jaden Daniels. God bless him. Love him. But there's no him holding that microphone at the start of a rally to free DC. And I don't mind that. I can't lie to you. I really don't. Because this is our fight. Bowser's not with us. John Wall does not live here anymore. But so what? No one will save us but us. We keep us safe. People might be familiar with those phrases as slogans or as abstractions, but make no mistake about it, in Washington, D.C., in 2025, in what used to be known as Chocolate City, but where the soul and heart of Chocolate City still beats, with all of that, please know that we are going to fight. And these slogans are not slogans, but they have become ways of life and ways of survival. No one will save us but us. We keep us safe. Yo, for Etan Thomas, Chuck Modiano, Coach McNutt, the great Katia Stitt, and of course Magic Mike on the Wheels of Steel, I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace.
Jazzy Sundays at Anacostia, an 8-week jazz and R&B concert series happening this Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m. in the heart of the Anacostia Arts District at 1234 Marion Barry Avenue. Food vendors will be on site and lawn chairs are welcome. Jazzy Sundays in Anacostia runs through Sunday, September the 7th. Details at anacostiabid.org.
WPFW presents Labor Standing in Solidarity, Monday, September 1st, a day of programming centering the concept of collective action and mutual support among workers to achieve common goods and protect their interests, turning rights into reality. We will also offer analysis of labor's role in global inequity, imperialism, and genocide. From 9 a.m. until 3 p.m., hosts Julian Malveaux, Joni Eisenberg, Elise Bryan and Chris Garlock, and Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash bring you the voices of workers and those organizing throughout the labor movement. From 3 until 11 p.m., we offer a sonic reflection of labor in solidarity provided by our all-women DJ collective meeting in the ladies' room. Workers' rights are human rights on your station for jazz and justice. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
It is with a heavy heart that the WPFW family marks the passing of Nkinji Touré. Born Anita Stroud on March 5, 1951, in Baltimore, Maryland. Nkinji was an activist whose expansive collection of speeches and written works confront issues around reproductive justice, black feminism, and women's rights. She was a vocal proponent of the anti-rape movement and continuously advocated for gender equality within the Black Nationalist Movement and the Black Panther Party. Later in life, Touré took on roles to improve quality of life for those struggling with both substance abuse and HIV/AIDS. In addition, Nkinji was a longtime WPFW producer and host of In Our Voices, and a member of the women's radio collective, Sophie's Parlor. She was instrumental in ensuring that International Women's Day programming was celebrated annually on WPFW. Homegoing services for Nkinji Touré are scheduled for Tuesday, September 2nd at J.B. Jenkins Funeral Home, 7474 Landover Road in Landover, Maryland, with viewing from 3:30 p.m. until 4:30 p.m. and service from 4:30 until 5:30 p.m. Repast to be held at the David C. Driscoll Community Park, 3911 Hamilton Street, Hyattsville, Maryland, from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Nkinji Touré, presente.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for jazz and justice, WPFW, Washington.
Are you ready to move, groove, and exercise with the WPFW family? WPFW's annual 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness happens Saturday, September 13th from 8 a.m. till 1 p.m. This fundraiser will be held at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. In addition to a scenic 5K trail, fitness and wellness classes will be offered. Lively music to fuel your participation in the activities, along with water and healthy snacks, will be provided. Details are at WPFWFM.org or call 202-888-5484. There's something for everyone to enjoy. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This
is Rev Yearwood, the host of Climate Friday. On Friday, August 29th, 9 a.m. until 7 p.m., we present From the Ninth Ward to the Airwaves, commemorating the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Produced by the Hip Hop Caucus in partnership with WPFW, our programming will highlight the community organizing being done in its wake, unpack the ongoing impact of the storm, center the voices of those who lived through it, and